Hey everyone, it's Tim Hemming here. I'm your host of today's Brexit podcast, and Theresa May has literally a couple of minutes ago just triggered Article 50. So we are thrashing through some of the details now to bring you a hot off the press show. And we've also got Joe Owen joining us from the Institute for Government, who's going to take us through a few of those details. I've got Jen Hahn, my co-host, with me. She's back from a kickboxing in Thailand. Most important questions first, Jen, how was Thailand?
Thailand? I didn't realise it was pronounced that way. But
oh my God, are you picking me up on my accent?
It was absolutely amazing, actually. And to be honest, I'd rather be on a beach back in Thailand right now than talking about this. But that's no matter, because we are, and we have to deal with
Come
this
on,
at some
stop.
Point, don't we?
You're sounding more grumpy than Donald Tusk. Did you see Donald Tusk?
No, what did he say?
So, Donald Tusk, EU Council President, he's in his speech, "This is not a happy day. However, it's made our community of 27 more determined and united than ever before. This is damage control. We minimise cost." And then he very sadly kind of ended his little talk with, "We miss you already." There did see kind of an air of, particularly in the European Council, a kind of air of general sadness around what was happening.
Yeah, I can imagine. I hope that's reflected in England as well. I haven't really, to be honest, because I've been in Thailand, I've not been paying too much attention. So this session is to get me up to speed as much as it is to get everyone else up to speed. So that should be quite interesting.
Yeah, that will be good. Joe will be joining us in a minute, so we will patch him in, as they say, when that's happened. But today, some people do say that. Yeah. Look, seven key points from Theresa May's Article 56-page letter. 7 points, 6-page letter. Number one, we should engage with others constructively and respectfully. We should always put our citizens first. We should work towards securing a comprehensive agreement, work together to minimise disruption, must pay attention to the unique relationship with the Republic of Ireland and Northern Ireland, begin technical talks on detailed policy areas as soon as possible, and prioritise the biggest challenges. We should continue to work to advance and protect our shared European values.
Does this not to you sound like one of those classroom contracts they have at primary schools where it's like, we will not chew gum in class, we will let others finish when they speak? Does this not sound quite similar to you?
Well, I think, as with all Theresa May's speeches, you need to read between the lines a little bit on some of this stuff. One thing that she did not say this time was, no deal is better than a bad deal. So
yeah.
Therefore, we got to strike a deal. That's May seems to be. This is, seems a little, the language here seems to be a little softer. We know we have to sort something out. One thing she was very hot on, which we can ask Joe about in a minute, but the early agreement on the principle of phased implementation. What do we think that means?
Isn't it?
Well, to me, that
I'm pretty sure that just means we're going to leave in stages rather than all at once, well, and we're going to phase different stuff out.
I think that means actually 2 years is nowhere near long enough to get this, to get the EU exodus and get us shot of this place. Actually, we need to really sort out the timeframes now, because I'm incredibly worried about this. I mean, we've spoken to many guests who have said 2 years is no chance in terms of getting the EU withdrawal process through with all the bills that have to happen. So I think that's definitely one that May is thinking of.
Yeah, I can imagine. Well, I think now it's time to get a view of the expert on, rather than us rambling on about it for much longer. So let's hear from Joe.
Hi, Joe. Welcome to the Brexit podcast.
Hi there.
Joe, it's official. We're leaving the European Atomic Energy Community, posh name for the EU. After 44 years, I just saw one commentator say, Theresa May's message was, you're dumped, but we still want to be friends. Article 50 has been triggered, 6-page letter out today. What's new? Any surprises in it?
Well, I think we got a lot more than we could have. I mean, it could have been as simple as saying, you know, dear Donald, we're leaving the EU, cheers, the UK, a very crude sense. But, you know, we got a lot more. It was much more expansive. It stuck a very diplomatic tone. It sort of started to recognise some of the challenges. It spoke to a European audience as much as a domestic audience. It was quite bold in the fact that it put, you know, the front foot forward on trying to set out some of the process by saying we want to negotiate withdrawal alongside our future arrangement, which of course the EU has always said it's exit first. It also said that the UK would be setting out some draft texts, and you know, it got into some of the details, and there were some, you know, interesting insights if you want to read into these things.
How realistic is the idea to do with withdrawal and come up with a deal concurrently? I mean, that it sounds like that's predicated on the fact that 2 years isn't really a very long time for Britain to leave the European Union.
Yeah, I think, you know, time is one constraint, and also the fact that some of the exit agreements will be shaped by what the continuing arrangement is. So I think you will see, you know, the UK is obviously keen to do them alongside for the purposes of time, but there's probably, from an EU perspective, it suits them quite well to have the UK sweating a little bit on time, saying we want to do withdrawal first. Of course, the withdrawal agreement touches on the status of EU nationals and British citizens abroad, which will be probably an area where there can be some quite quick agreement. I mean, there's probably a bit more detail into it where the issues get a little bit thornier in terms of rights within the country. But generally speaking, that could be fairly quickly resolved. But also within the withdrawal agreement, and probably why the EU is keen to get it sorted quickly, is this Brexit bill. And the EU will be keen to have that at the top of the agenda.
Now, there's obviously been a lot of furore, so to say, today about this signing of Article 50, but is it not just a formality at this point, or are there any immediate effects that are kind of come into effect straight away?
Well, I think, you know, if anything, it sets the clock going, right, on the 2 year countdown. So it's important and symbolic in that respect. It also, as I said, started to set out some of these process questions and what really will follow. You know, this document is obviously significant, but what will follow and the EU's response is equally significant. And what you'll see over the next few months is not the big set piece negotiations, but talks about talks, negotiations about negotiations. So conversations about what does doing exits and future deals alongside one another actually look like, what will the EU accept, what will be the sequencing of issues, how will they break up the trade deal, what will the chapters be, all of these things which sound pretty bureaucratic and dull can actually be quite important in adjusting the balance of power in the negotiations. So I think what you'll see is, you know, 3 to 6 months of talks about talks. I mean, the EU will be meeting at the end of April, the 29th of April. There's the European Council summit to discuss the guidelines, which will be their response to the letter, their sort of formal detailed response. And then June will be a summit of the UK and the EU27, where they will really, you know, get into the process of negotiations and start to agree how they will look. There's also the question of how the EU will agree its mandate. There's a big negotiation that has to happen within the EU before we even get to the negotiating table, with the 27 having to agree on what their positions are, what their red lines are. So it could be autumn before the two sides sit round the table and start to negotiate proper.
Now, of course, a lot of the big players in Europe have got their own elections happening as well, which are probably going to take priority, aren't they, over what Britain wants for the likes of Italy, Germany, France.
Yeah, so France and Germany are clearly big players in the European Union, and France already has its eyes on the domestic agenda and the elections there. That will be the case for the next few months. And then Germany, of course, in the autumn with their elections, you know, what we've heard is that the attention there is already starting to be on the domestic agenda rather than, you know, getting into Brexit or international, you know, EU issues substantively. But, you know, in a sense, there are lots of things that officials and negotiators will be working through. There'll be lots of detailed text that each side will sit down and go through and work out where they agree or where they disagree. And it will only be on these really thorny issues, on these really politically contentious issues, where the heads of state will be in the room and will be doing the negotiating. So even though these elections will be going on, there will be teams that can get a fair amount of the legwork done.
Is there any chance then that if power switches in any of these major European countries to a different party that wants different things from Brexit, that any negotiations or agreements that were made earlier in the year before the elections happened get sort of thrown out again because of the election?
Well, I think the biggest concern will be France and what happens in France if Marine Le Pen wins, because obviously that is a bigger question for the European Union. So that's probably the biggest example of where, you know, any domestic change in the EU27 could have a big impact on Brexit negotiations. But there'll be lots of things that pop up over the course of the 2 years, which is why, you know, it's quite likely that political leaders will get distracted or their attention will divert away from Brexit. But there will be these teams of negotiators who will be dedicated to this, who will be working through the detail and highlighting what the big issues are that can then go up to the political leaders for discussion.
From a British perspective, have all those posts been taken now? I read recently that we were still looking to recruit a whole host of Brexit negotiators.
So we haven't heard whether they've all been filled or not and what the exact structure of the detailed negotiating team will be. I mean, what you would imagine will happen is there'll be an agreement with the EU over the next few months about what are the chapters of this trade deal. So what are the big sections that will need to be discussed? And each of those sections will have a lead negotiator and a team around them. You know, some of them from across Whitehall. So if it's a section on agriculture or the environment, you'd imagine there'll be someone from the Department for Environment, Food and Rural Affairs in the negotiating team. And these teams will be working through these issues themselves, and what will then, you know, jump up to the chief negotiators, as I said, the thorny issues.
What do you foresee being the thorny ones?
Well, it's difficult.
Or is everything potentially a thorn?
It's difficult to tell. I mean, you'd imagine there's lots that the UK would be happy to keep, you know, in the details around environmental policy, for example, or some of the regulatory areas where actually it's something that the UK, I mean, this is in terms of a future trade deal that
yeah.
The UK would be happy to keep. You know, people didn't vote to leave on, you know, water quality, for example. There's areas to do with science and research and the European research area where you'd imagine that would be a fairly easy chapter to agree on if they wanted to, because the UK is perfectly happy with the scientific collaboration it has with the EU. So that, you know, there will be areas where it will be a sort of, yeah, really happy with how it's gone over the last however many years. Let's keep it as it is. But there will be, of course, you know, some of the thorny areas. The bill is clearly, in terms of the withdrawal agreement, the Brexit bill will be a big point of discussion, where the UK has mentioned in the letter, the Article 50 letter, that it recognises the rights and obligations that it has as an EU member, which starts to talk about, you know, it starts to address this Brexit bill concept. But you'd imagine if there's a big £50 billion even bill that's slammed down on the table, there'll probably be, that would be considered one of the thornier issues, I'd imagine.
Yes, the crazy divorce bill, as I think UKIP leader Paul Nuttall said earlier today, he wants to be the guard dogs of Brexit, control our borders and our waters. Just on, in terms of the less contentious stuff and porting across EU regulation, effectively a cut and paste, let's say, of water quality, are there any costs associated with that for Britain? I mean, can we just do that? Does somebody hold the intellectual property rights? Is there a massive, is it as straightforward as just copying what's already there?
So this is what we'll see through the Great Repeal Bill white paper, is how government is going to approach this, the legislative transfer, basically, from the EU, where the plan will be to basically do a big copy and paste of EU law and dump it into the UK statute books. But the reality with that is there are areas, as you say, that it's more complicated than just being able to do that. There'll be references to EU bodies or EU agencies that, you know, perform, say, a regulatory function that being outside of the EU will potentially not have access to. So these are some of the questions that officials have been working through. They sort of quite quickly got off the mark after the referendum to go through the body of EU law. I think David Davis has talked about tens of thousands of pages of statute that teams across Whitehall have been going through to identify, you know, exactly that point. Where is the law easily transferable and you can just do this sort of lift and shift? Or where is the law, what they use, the term they use is inoperable, which means it just doesn't function without you being part of the EU. So in some instances, these fixes might be, well, where would someone report to if they're not reporting to a European body? Is there, you know, a natural home in one of the departments or the UK regulatory bodies that will pick up this reporting, this reporting job? Or, you know, will it require a whole new regulatory body to be set up? These are, you know, these are some of the questions that will need to be worked through and from the legislative perspective.
So when it comes to all these changes actually being made, May has asked for an early agreement on the principle of phased implementation. Tim and I have already voiced our own separate opinions of what exactly that sort of vague term means. Could you give us a rundown of what you think it entails?
So I think phased implementation means that the deal, Theresa May wants the deal wrapped up in 2 years, but recognises that there's one thing, agreeing the new customs agreement and the new customs arrangement and how we will trade with the EU. There's another thing, having Dover, Fishguard, all of these ports ready to actually enact that new trade agreement, having them ready on the customs controls so that there's not huge queues. And, you know, this also applies to the EU, who will need to make sure that Calais has the appropriate systems and processes in place to adapt to this new relationship. So I think by phased implementation, it's a recognition that, you know, even if an agreement happens, many of these things will take time to actually implement and adjust to. And as smooth as possible will be the target, without, you know, wanting to try and avoid any sort of cliff edge, as they say, disrupt UK businesses or European businesses.
A couple of people that have no intention on making this as smooth as possible are Nicola Sturgeon and Angus Robertson. Within a few minutes of the letter being read out, the SNP were already making new calls for an independence referendum once more. Theresa May's been very clear nothing's going to happen until Brexit's gone through and totally enacted. Have Sturgeon and Robertson got anywhere to go with this, or is this eventually going to die down?
It's hard to tell. I think the letter did speak to Scotland slightly. There was mention of the additional powers that would be devolved to, you know, Scotland, Northern Ireland, and Wales as a result of the Brexit process. There was reassurance that this wouldn't be seen as a process that would centralise even more power into Westminster. So I think those sorts of things will be said, conscious of the Scottish audience, and trying to avoid having a second independence referendum, especially when you note the timing that the SNP have put forward, which is basically right at the thick end of negotiations and when there will be pressure on to prepare for life outside the EU and start putting some of these systems and processes in place. So I think, you know, wherever possible, Theresa May will look to try and delay it.
I suppose a cynic might say that she wants to devolve more powers now, because with the EU funding drying up to these areas that can sort of go and fend for themselves because there's no more cash in the system. But I don't necessarily expect you to have a comment on that one, Joe.
A cynic may say that.
Thank you. Joe, thanks ever so much for joining us today and giving us kind of helping us clarify a little bit of the Article 50 stuff. We will look forward to catching up with you soon.
I As always, thanks for listening. And if you enjoy the show, please subscribe to us on your podcast platform of choice so you'll be notified whenever we upload a new episode and you'll be able to tune in. In the meantime, you can find us at brexitpodcast.com and on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram at brexitpodcast. The show is produced by Jennifer Han, Tim Hemming, and Warren Paul, and our theme song is Cool Vibes by Kevin MacLeod.